Dogs make the best companions for humans, this podcast aims to help make humans better companions for their dogs. Welcome to the Beru Podcast, a modern lifestyle podcast for dogs and their people. I'm your host, Charlotte Bain. I've been caring for other people's dogs for more than 15 years. And while I've learned a lot in my career, I definitely don't know it all. So I've collected an ever-evolving roster of amazing dog people, and I learn new things from them all the time. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Beru Podcast. In today's episode, I have a really lovely chat with Sindor Pongal. Sindor is a canine behavior consultant, Galen myotherapist, and an independent ethology researcher studying the free living dogs in India. She's also an educator in Bangalore, India, and an engineer by qualification. In addition, she's a TEDx speaker and the author of the book, Dog Knows. She's currently pursuing her master's in anthrozoology from Exeter University, and while she wears many hats, Sindor's favorite role has been being a mommy to two amazing dogs, Nishi, who recently passed away, and Chiru, who she considers her inspiration and her greatest teachers. We chat about what her studies of street dogs, or streeties as she calls them, in India has taught her about canine behavior and how what she's learned can help us to be better pet parents to our own pups. She also touches on the concept of decolonization when it comes to our companion animals. So let's just jump into the chat. Well, first of all, I so appreciate you jumping on and chatting with me. This is really special, and I'm really excited about this conversation. So before we jump into start talking about one of your specialties, which one of your focuses of your research is on street dogs, streeties, is a terminology that you like to use. I always love to hear people's inspiration and the journey behind how they ended up working with or studying, in your case, studying and working with dogs. Because I do find that there's a lot of crossover for many people, even though the journeys are separate. But oftentimes it comes from their own dog, trying to fulfill a need in their own dog or between of the relationship they had with their dog, whether their dog is, you know, reactive or struggling with, you know, health issues or numerous certain things. That's always a lot of the people that I've chatted with, and a lot of people that I know who work with animals, it's usually been inspired by their own special guy. So what was your inspiration in your journey, and maybe a little bit about what you did before you jumped into working with animals?
Yeah, so before I started working with dogs, I qualified as an engineer, and I worked for a company that you may have heard of, Yahoo.
Oh yeah, that one. Somewhere around
May
there.
May its soul rest in peace. It's no more in that form, but and there's a joke out here that in Bangalore City in India, this is considered the Silicon Valley of India, and there's a joke that if you threw a stone here, you would hit a software engineer, and I'm definitely, or rather, was one of them. And then I moved from there to the startup space. So high tech was my thing. And then I was beginning to get quite disillusioned with the corporate world. And around that time, my dog, Nishi, like you said, these journeys, the most meaningful journeys are most often very personal. And so my dog, Nishi, a lovely boxer who was just 11 months old, got ran over by a car. And my miracle puppy, she survived. I mean, the car ran over her face, so it took half her face with it. And so she was in and out of surgery for a long, long time. And that survivor puppy of mine, my God, she pulled through and how. But I didn't know enough about dogs then, but I knew enough to have known that dogs who go through trauma of this kind do have an emotional fallout, at least to the extent that I had seen that these dogs turn into biting dogs. And having a boxer who was quite a big boxer, I think at least you know, there was that fear that kind of led me in the direction of looking for answers. How would I even manage life with, you know, a biting boxer? And so I suppose in a way it was selfish as well. But the other aspect of it was also that I knew that from an emotional perspective, whatever she struggled, I mean, I have my own anxieties and mental health issues, and I knew that no form of training would really address what I suspected she was going to struggle with. And so I started looking for something beyond that, and I think I'm glad that it led me in the right direction. I discovered Ture Drugas from Norway, who was talking about communicating with dogs, understanding their needs, and that really was the right approach. It helped us a lot. And as anticipated, Nishi did develop dog reactivity issues. She was terrified of, so she was playing with another dog when this happened, and she was, and he was her best friend, and you know, after this whole thing, suddenly she couldn't handle him anymore. And she turned dog reactive in general. And I was just, I just didn't know what to do. And so I suppose my journey started there. And I must, I must let you know that it did turn out very well for us. She did make friends back with the dog she was playing with, Mojo. I write about this in my book as well.
Oh, good.
And so, subsequently, not only did her dog reactivity go away, and I write about this extensively, and I kind of talk about it a lot as well in my classes and things like that, and just in general when I teach, because she showed me how amazing dogs can be, how resilient they can be. She turned into a fantastic mentor. We fostered a lot of dogs in her care, and she brought them out of their shell. And she was so good with dogs that my journey into understanding street dogs or streeties also started with her. She had this amazing patience, and she was an incorrigibly friendly dog. She believed in her heart that there was no dog or human who would not like her. I think that's the mark of a secure dog, right? So she believed that I am awesome and everybody loves me. And so she won dogs over with just so much patience, and I learned to learn from her. So that's kind of the motto of our school as well, learning to learn from dogs, which is I learned while here I was trying to push my agenda on dogs, the real way to earn trust and earn friendships, Nishi was showing me how to do it. Even my dog Chiru now, when we got her, she was terrified to the point where she's a rescue and she was abused. And so the first few months, Nishi so much as moved within her line of sight, she would growl. For the first few days, she didn't even move into my house. She dug a hole in the garden and she sat there and she didn't move into my house. And today, Chiru is fabulous. I share videos of her, and you may have seen that on my social media. And who she is today is Nishi's gift. Who we all are today is Nishi's gift, really. And Nishi showed me how you actually win over, not win over, but win the trust, earn the trust of a dog, or create that secure connection, secure attachment with the, with another dog, teach another dog what it means. Secure attachment is one part of it. So with a dog like Chiru or the fosters, right, what it means to show up, to be there. And the other is to sort of put them at ease, to tell them, look, I'm not a threat, so it's worth getting to know me. Let's try. And what it actually takes to do it. It's not like she went around dispensing treats and clicking and whatnot, right? There's something else that she used. And when I let go of my hubris that I knew and started looking at her to look at what she knew, I realized that there was so much to uncover there that no expert in the world could teach me. I always say this. Even with my students who come to me, I tell them, I am not the expert of your dog. Your dog is the expert of your dog. They know what is right for them. And what I'm going to do, or what I can hope to do, is to empower you to learn from your dog you know, listen to your dog and learn from them and bring out the best in them, because they know what it takes to bring out the best in them. They can give you the feedback on that. And so let's see if you can figure that out. So that's where I started off, and I subsequently studied with Toured, and I decided to do this as a full-time job. And there were a few moments, a few claims that Toured was making that I felt were very controversial. And so, having a critical mind, I felt like I didn't want to take somebody's word for something. I wanted to go check it out myself. So I started researching with free living dogs. So that's kind of where my interest in free living dogs started. Though I've grown up around them for several decades now, and shared my life with them for a long, long time, I think that kind of a structured academic inquiry started around there. And now I'm doing my master's at Exeter in the UK in anthropozoology, and that's giving me new vocabulary and new ways to look at this whole journey, leading me away from quantitative ways of inquiry, which I'm familiar with as an engineer, as a software engineer. That's really my go-to and my comfort zone. And so I'm being dragged out of that comfort zone into looking at qualitative inquiry. And it's a whole new world, which I'd love to. I will definitely reference some of those things today.
Okay, that's fantastic. It's anthropozoology?
Yeah, that's right. So it's an offering from the anthropology department. So just as anthropology looks at history of humankind, anthropozoology looks at human-animal entanglements through different eras, through time, through religion, through different geographies, through different industries, media, and things like that. So just whenever and wherever humans and animals have crossed paths, we have interest in looking and discussing.
That's cool. That's really cool. Can't wait to hear more about what you've learned. That's fantastic. Yeah. So do you want to jump into talking a bit about, you're very specific in the terminology that you use for street dogs or streeties. I know a lot of us will say, here we'd say strays, but you are very specific that there are differences between a stray dog, a street dog, or a free living dog, and a wild dog, right? I think we tend to lump them all together into one kind of idea of what we have of dogs living on the street. Do you want to kind of dive into a little bit of the differences between those and why we need to really be mindful about how we think of it?
I think if you're just having a conversation at a cocktail party, it wouldn't matter. But that's not what we're doing, right? We are hypothesizing on this. We are doing studies on this. We are some people are even doing scientific studies that go into peer-reviewed papers. And so terminology matters a lot. You won't do a study on just men and then call it a representative of humankind. Well, we do, but we know what the problem there is. So it... and that's the reason why we need to be specific. So first and foremost, the term wild dog is just wildly inappropriate, because we have wild dogs in India. They are not the same species. They are not Canis familiaris. They're Cuon Alpino. And so it would be like studying cats and saying, hey, let's talk, you know, let's think about dogs based on these studies. They're just a different species.
Interesting.
They live very differently. Yeah. They have nothing to do with dogs. They it's really the most inaccurate term of the lot. So locally, they're called dholes. They're seen in the forests of India. And I think there are also wild dog species in Africa. I don't know what the local name is. But you can look it up and you'll see that they're an entirely different species altogether. A stray animal, the word has a lot of connotations. It means that the animal has strayed from somewhere. They do not belong in a particular place. They are matter out of place. They were somewhere that they did belong, and now they're existing in a space where they don't belong. So usually companion dogs or captive dogs or pet dogs who have for some reason stopped being in that living arrangement, either they were abandoned or lost or whatever, or they're given a semi-roaming lifestyle, those, and they're kind of caught out of context, those could be considered stray animals. And with our free living dogs in India, the street is they do not belong to that category. They were never pet dogs, not for generations. They were born and brought up on the streets. Well, I won't say they weren't for generations because there is, crossbreeding. And so that's a whole other thing that I also want to touch upon, which is significant for this conversation. But these are dogs that have been living on these streets for generations. And so they are kind of in the true sense, free living animals. They never belonged to anybody. and they don't, they're not feral either, because again, the term feral technically is a domestic animal that has now gone wild. That's the loose definition in which we use it. And again, you can see technically why that just doesn't describe streeties. But also the term feral is often very loaded. So when you picture a feral animal, you're picturing an animal that's, very, gets into a lot of conflict with human beings. You're picturing scratches and bites, but
rabies, all sorts of things. Yeah.
And, and of course, free living dogs do carry zoonotic diseases. That's a whole other thing by itself, but these are also very, very friendly animals. Again, if you see my social media, you'll see pictures and videos of them just, I can't stop them from approaching me within few seconds of just eye contact, and they're like, hi. Sometimes I make fun saying that they're a little too friendly for their own good. Human beings are not exactly non-feral towards them, if at all. So sometimes I worry that they're a little too trusting, but my goodness, they are so friendly, at least in cities like Bangalore, where they're not faced with too much there'll always be a little bit of conflict, but not too much persecution. In India, they are protected constitutionally, so you cannot move them, relocate them, hurt them, or kill them. You cannot remove them and put them into shelters and gas them and things like that. Those are all considered illegal. So in places where that spirit is kind of upheld by concerned citizens, you see that these dogs tend to be very, very friendly. It's a very common sight. If you're in a cafe in India, there's going to be a plump dog sitting next to you saying, I like cookies. And usually the barista will come and tell you, oh, if you want to feed that dog, don't feed those cookies. This is the one he likes. And so the term feral, stray, wild, none of them apply. They're free living dogs. But the term free living dogs also is kind of falls short to describe them, because they definitely have very different behaviors based on the living condition that they are in. So if they are outside of city limits, if they are away from human existence, they tend to show a very different ethogram compared to if they're in the heart of the city, or if they're in parts of the country where they are persecuted illegally. You see very different behaviors. We also see very different behaviors of with free living dogs in the mountains versus in the beach areas. And they've not been studied well enough. So you see, the term doesn't really do them justice.
Right.
And so I prefer to use the word streeties, because I think it's colloquial, it's non-technical. I'm not pretending to, know more than I know. And I am not pretending to be unbiased. I am telling you straight up my affection. I'm telling you how loosely I am using the term. And I think that's a more honest term, quite honestly. And that's the reason why I stick with this term. And I think it's quite important that we differentiate. What exactly are you talking about? If you do a study on them, who are the dogs you did the study on? Don't just use some term and expect that to work across all dogs all over the world.
Right. You were saying that they communicate, you were saying essentially they communicate differently or show up differently in urban settings versus the mountains versus the beach. Do you know, and I'm sure more study is needed, but do you know, what are some of those differences, and do you have any idea why they show up differently?
So I think dogs are, if anything, they are highly, highly, highly adaptable, and they are highly responsive to human beings around them. I think that's kind of their specialty, that they've been doing this for, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years. So I think one of the things that you will see in dogs, I mean, we see this with all urban animals, right? We see that they're evolving to kind of mold into the environment that's being created for them. And so these dogs are specialists at evolving around human beings. And so I think that's kind of what you see. I don't want to speculate too much about the beaches and the mountains. I suspect it has something to do with the state of mind people are in when they're there. But at least with dogs that are in the city versus dogs that kind of live on the outskirts of cities, you see a distinct difference in their friendliness towards human beings. And that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you are bang in the middle of a busy metro, you better be friendly and not afraid of human beings. Otherwise, you're not going to go too far. And also, dogs inside cities are extremely good at reading people, approaching people, knowing who to approach, knowing who to ask for food. So food procurement is something that you see a big difference in. Dogs within friendly cities like Bangalore, their primary mode of procuring food, a lot of people think they're scavengers, but no, their primary mode is begging. They are very good at figuring out who, where to turn up, who to beg, how to beg. And it's just, it's one of those things that I feel like I must study a lot more. So most of us who have our dogs sitting and begging when we are having pizzas, I think that's an evolutionary thing and they are masters at it. Mm-hmm. And I think there are also studies that show that, you know, we generate hormones that kind of make us suspend logic when we make that eye contact. So you see them kind of using their big, beautiful, you know, ultra big eyes and that, you know, the neoteny, the baby face, the juvenile face.
Yeah.
Whereas,
happy dog eyes.
Whereas dogs who live on the outskirts of the cities rely more on scavenging and a little bit more hunting, and they are wary of human beings. So their food procurement is different, and I think as a result of it, their social structure is also different. They tend to be, they tend to live more in groups. They tend to hunt, procure food. They rely on their entire group. I won't use the word pack because that's kind of not very accurate, but they use their entire group as a way to procure food. So hunting done as a group can be more effective, whereas begging done as a group can be a disaster. If you know, you had a pack, you know, a pack of 10 dogs turning up near, you know, near a bakery or a cafe, people would be terrified. But one cute dog turning up can be endearing. Yeah. And so you see that city dogs tend to have a social structure where it's much more loose. They tend to do things a bit more independently or in pairs. And they also utilize group structures where necessary. So they may sleep in the company of a lot of dogs because, you know, there's safety in numbers there. But when they go to procure food, they tend to break up into smaller groups. And I even see them kind of pick up their friends from the neighboring group and then the two of them will go off together. So they have a lot of that very, very complicated, beautiful, rich social life going on. I know a lot less about dogs that live on the outskirts because obviously they are wary of us. So I've not gotten a chance to observe them. But what is striking for me is that they're usually in larger numbers. They band together. They procure food differently. And I suspect that the way they treat each other then also becomes different because they're living together as just like human beings, right? Human beings who live in small groups versus human beings who live in a large, you know, combined family, you're going to see a lot more drama and politics. And there's so many dynamics to take into account. Whereas with two people, it's gets a little bit simplified, but maybe also intensified. So again, this is all speculation here, but I think this is why I feel like we need to differentiate these terms and have closer examination, and we can't lump the terms together.
Right. That makes complete and total sense. When you were talking about how the streeties in the city tend to, you know, they come up, they beg and they can identify. How do they identify who is someone that they want to approach? I mean, are they reading our facial cues? We know dogs can read, you know, we suspect they can read our subtle facial cues. And I'm wondering if that's, they can see it from afar or there's a, vibe we're giving out. I don't know. How do they know who they should approach and who they shouldn't approach?
Yes.
Right? I'm assuming not everyone is on board with feeding dogs, or everyone is on board with, you know, having dogs in their environment, like anywhere else. I'm sure some people aren't fond of the idea.
Yeah.
So do you want to expand on that a
little bit? Yeah. So you nailed it, right? That's exactly the thing. Humans are diverse and dogs recognize that. And so they have to identify. So these are the lessons we need to learn from them, right? They are willing to recognize that we are diverse. Why don't we recognize that they are too, right? So they do recognize that it's not just that, you know, not everybody is friendly towards them. So you see that of the people, some of them are scared. Some of them are violent towards them. Some of them want to intentionally hurt them. And this is beautiful. Some of them will deceive them and then hurt them. There are going to be people who pretend to draw them in and then hurt them. So dogs have to not only factor in, oh, do you like dogs or not like dogs, but also factor in, is there deception in your liking? And I think that is a remarkable thing. How they do it is a great question. I don't have answers to it. Well, I have theories, and so my dissertation is actually going to go in that direction, and hopefully I'll study this further. But I think they have become masters at paying attention to our body language, eye contact. I see that something as simple as a quick eye contact with them. You know, there are millions of dogs in India, and many of us free living dogs in India, and people who don't particularly like them don't even notice them, whereas those of us who like them will notice them. And so eye contact, recognizing that they are there, is a starting point. Second thing, we don't have fear in our faces. We don't have fear in our body language. Again, they're very good at seeing that. They're very good at seeing if we're stiffening up or we're relaxed and you smile. Oh my goodness. So there are already lab studies that show that dogs are so good at reading facial expressions that they can assess just the top half or the bottom half of our face and see if we are expressing, what emotions we are experiencing and expressing. They're so good at reading it with our eyes or, you know, the bottom half of our face. So and I've tried a little bit of experimenting, trying to be deceptive about it. But of course, my deception goes in the other direction. I have tried looking like I'm annoyed with them, but it's very hard for me to pull off because they're being terribly cute.
Right.
And I can see that they are not buying it at all. They look at me and they're like, no, no, we see you for who you are. And I suspect that they're reading that composite. You can't kind of separate out, is it eyes, voice, you know, pheromones.
Right.
I think that composite thing is what they're reading. I've seen dogs also, cautious dogs, take a step back and wait to see how you treat other dogs. Again, there are studies that show that their dogs are not only good at paying attention to this by proxy, but also with dogs, but with humans too. So they watch how we treat other humans. They watch how we treat other animals. They watch how we treat other dogs. This group in front of my house, three girls, Chaita, Iti, and Yaya, and one guy. And the guy, I've had a very innovative name for him. I've called him Dude. the three girls have always been very friendly towards me. They're a family. Dude is the father. Chaita is the mom. The three girls have been very friendly. Dude has never, ever been around a human being. It's very obvious. He's never... this is a very large farm area. Mine is a small farm, but many surrounding farms not populated at all. So many dogs out here have never touched a human or been touched by a human. And so Dude is definitely one such dog. So he has been cautious of me for a year now. I've been here for a year. But he's been observing what the other dogs do. They come and they jump on me, they get petted, and this guy looks and they're like, and I can almost see it in his face. What is it that all of you are getting from this woman? Why are you going near the human? We don't go near humans. And then slowly over time, his curiosity has been getting the better of him. So when all of them come, particularly when they're excited and all of them come running and they're, you know, kind of fussing around me, and then he comes and stands on the edge, and at first he would just try and put his snout in and then pull it back very quickly, and finally we have managed to make contact and touch him. He's still cautious, but they pay a lot of attention to those kind of details as well. And I haven't added a lot more in, but I think already you can begin to see how complicated this is. There is a lot going on out here, and this is, I think, their specialty. I think knowing how to read human beings can mean life or death for these dogs. Mm-hmm. You approach the wrong human being and terrible things can happen to you. But at the same time, your survival depends on them. If you look at the dogs around here, Chaita, Iti and Yaya, because they're so approachable, even if they have a tiny infection on them, a cut or bruise, I will... Mm-hmm. You know, there'll be medical intervention. I will go put something on it and heal them. Whereas with Dude, chances are that I'm not going to be able to do much. So who do you think at the end is going to survive and have a longer life, right? It is going to be the ones who learn how to approach us, but at the same time, learn how not to approach people who are likely to hurt them. So that distinction is one of those survival skills that they need to have. You know, like the giraffe has a tall neck. The dog knows how to read the human. I think that's their thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's true. And I see it with, you know, I mean, in a different sense with, you know, the dogs that I work with. If we have a shy or a nervous dog, obviously they have had, you know, contact with humans because they have, you know, a human parent of some sort. But it may have distrust of humans that are not their parents, or even of their own parents. Who knows? But I see them, their hesitation, and how they wait and watch, and sometimes for months on end until they gain the confidence from the other dogs in their ability to, you know, feel more comfortable around a new person or a new human. But it often takes the other dogs more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
To really make that shift for them, I think. Well, I want to know what some of the most important things, and that you, in addition to the dog's ability and need to read and assess a situation when it involves, you know, humans for their livelihood or for their life or death situation, what are some of the most important things that you've learned in your studying of dogs, and maybe some of the most, maybe something that's like unexpected that you've learned while studying streeties?
So I think a lot is unexpected. Quite honestly, I think that our understanding of animals is to a great extent driven by what we want them to be rather than what they are. And so I think a lot of studies so far have been focused on what we are interested in, what we are capable of getting them to do, and, you know, those kind of things. And we've paid so little attention to what they actually are and what they're good at and things like that. And even with looking at what they're good at, I think the interest has been, what are they good at that we can use? What are they good at that we can exploit? So that's been our focus area for a lot of studies. And so I think who dogs are inherently has just, you know, it's been left out of the conversation for a great deal. So I think the starting point, of course, like I said, one of the first few things that got me started was Turid said something about their activity levels, saying, you know, something that we hear a lot of in the dog world is they're highly active animals, so we have to exercise them a lot, do a lot with them. And she kept insisting, no, that's not true. That's not who dogs are. That's not really true. And so I didn't want to take her word for it, and I decided to look at the activity budget of dogs, and that kind of created a short ethogram. So I followed them several packs of groups of dogs and several individual dogs over, say, about 4 years. And the ethogram revealed to me that she was kind of right in that they were not very active dog. They didn't animals. They didn't move a lot. They didn't cover large territories. Here, of course, and they can't cover large territories because of the density with which they exist around human beings. When there are humans, we always create an ecological niche where dogs can also exist. It's a, you know, we share that niche. So there are always going to be dogs. And they do have ideas of territories. They do have ideas of, hey, this is my street. My, you know, this, you know, your boundary ends here and my boundary starts here. So they can't exactly cross and go on, you know, long drives and long, you know, excursions. Here, because this space is so sparsely populated by humans, it's also kind of sparsely populated by dogs. And so the dogs do get space here. But again, I don't see them covering large distances on a regular basis. They may cover, and large distance, when I say, I mean maybe a couple of miles at most, 2-3 miles at most. And maybe once a week or so. And they almost do it like a Sunday outing kind of a thing. They will go to the lake, spend time there.
Let's go check this out. Yeah.
And come back. But it's not in search of food. And I think the Coppingers kind of explained this beautifully. They captured this idea beautifully, and I see this in action. They said wolves evolved to cover large distances in search of food, whereas dogs evolved to sit in one place and wait for food to arrive. And when I say food to arrive, I mean, you know, garbage, because that's really what dogs survive on. They are scavenging animals as well, along with begging. And I think that that was the part that was missed out. I think dogs also evolved to sit in one place and look cute. And I think their neoteny speaks to that. I think they look appealing to human beings as a species. They, in general, don't move a lot. They sleep for most of the day, and when they're not sleeping, they're just watching. They sit and watch, they stand and watch, they lie down and watch, and they largely watch human beings. If there are human beings around, that's kind of their focal point. And it makes sense again, watching our every move. Most times the dog will know every routine of every human being around. So watching us that closely, even for a free living dog, I think our movements matter so much. Watching our artifacts, watching how we treat other animals, they pay attention to all of that more than we can ever imagine. So I think that was surprising to me. The other thing is a myth that goes around a lot is dogs are den animals. That is something that I do not see at all. I call them sofa animals because not that free living dogs always have access to sofas, but on the few rare occasions that somebody has thrown a sofa outside, you'll definitely see a dog go and claim it very quickly. But in general, they like sleeping sprawled out on elevated surfaces. So you can even see them frequently sleeping on top of cars, which car owners don't particularly appreciate that because they leave scratch marks when they climb up. But if people let them into their houses, they will go up to the rooftop. They will climb on top of shops. Generally, elevated surfaces, and there's a chance that you're going to see a dog, some dog occupying that. If not, open spaces. They are social sleepers. They like sleeping in company. They're not lone animals, they don't like to be isolated. So that's another big thing for many of us who get dogs and kind of put them in confinement, like crates and things like that. It can deprive them of sleep. They need company. They need movement. They are also polyphasic sleepers. They sleep throughout the day. They're not nocturnal or diurnal animals. They kind of, they're crepuscular animals, so they kind of sleep almost throughout the day in bits and pieces. They're not monophasic sleepers like us. They don't sleep one shot. So they will sleep a little, get up. And I think there are studies that show their sleep architecture itself. They have shorter REM cycles and shorter bursts of sleep. So they'll sleep for a short period, get up, move, sleep again. I suspect that movement has to also do with temperature regulation and the ability for them to have a vantage point where they can feel safe. They feel like they can see what they want to keep an eye out on. And mm-hmm. so a lot of those factors. So that was, again, something that Turin was talking about that I did find with the dogs. Something that things that I also found, which were not part of the conversation back then, but I think we need to pay a lot of attention to, and I've touched upon these already, is their extraordinarily rich and complicated social lives and the way they mm-hmm. communicate with each other and the way they communicate with dogs. With humans and the way they read us. I think that is a kind of a depth of information which I've not seen really anybody even scratching the surface in any academic literature or anywhere for that matter. And since I've started paying closer attention to that, I am just, it's shock and awe. And mm-hmm. I've been trying to see if I can find a way to procure like a trap camera that I can put outside my house to bring like a live feed in for people who want to watch, because my goodness, the complexity. I talk about, and I've been corresponding with Dr. Beckhoff on this, and I tell him that, and he talks about some of these ideas, which are often considered anthropomorphic if we use it in the context of dogs. But I think some of these cognitive ethologists like Beckhoff and Sapolsky have been arguing that it doesn't do justice to animals if we don't talk about this in the animal world, just assuming that they don't have it. So, for instance, things like vendetta, politics, and friendship in the true nature of friendship, which means that they can be friends today. They can have a falling out tomorrow. They can stop being friends. And I have definitely seen that. I talk about this more recent incidences. One of the dogs here, I named him Elvis because he has a habit of singing when he's happy. And he used to be quite popular amongst all the dogs. I used to see Chaita and him play. My dog Chiru looked like she had a big crush on him. So, you know, they would all play.
Aww.
And then suddenly, I think in the last 2 or 3 months, something has happened. He's fallen out of favor with all the dogs. All of them are angry with him. Mm. All of them have been asking him to go away. They bark. When I was very surprised to see, they were all barking, hackles raised. And I went out to see what's going on. And it was Elvis. And I said, what's going on, guys? He's your friend. I thought he was your friend. Why have you guys gotten angry with him? And it's not just one or two. All of them, the dogs on the back, the dogs in the front, the dogs inside, all of them have suddenly become very unfriendly towards him. And so what's going on there? Well, you know, they were friends once upon a time. Why did this happen? We don't know. We don't know how are friendships forged, how are they broken, what are the criteria for it. The concept of culture among dogs, different, and this concept of culture is a bit more studied in the context of primates, and we have seen that primates show something like culture, which is primates, mm-hmm. same species in one part, one geography, or, you know, one group, propagate certain practices that are not necessarily part of another group. And that's what culture is, right? Cultural mm-hmm. practices. Mm-hmm. So that kind of a concept I do see amongst dogs as well. These dogs here mm-hmm. seem to have a certain play style that other dogs do not have. Chiru's play style is different from the dogs in front of me. So I call her. She seems to have a body slamming style of play, which she seems to have picked up from her boxer mentor, Nishi. Uh-huh. Whereas uh-huh. I call these guys uh-huh. the leg biters. Their idea of play seems to be going around and biting each other's legs. And so they have mm-hmm. severe miscommunication. Yeah. They're not able to play with each other. And I think it's a cultural thing. It's, I think, dog canine culture. And so that's another concept that we do not understand very well, but I'm definitely seeing the existence of these concepts with them. So, yeah, that's a kind of a longish answer to your question. But as you can see, there's more questions I have uncovered than answers. But I think the questions are important in their own right.
Absolutely. That's so cool. You have talked about the concept of decolonization when it comes to dogs. And that's a concept that I've never crossed my mind, that those two things went together. And I researched a little bit more. Now it makes a little bit more sense to me. And I was wondering if you could expand on that. And I think it's really important. And I think it's really important that you are bringing this kind of to the forefront a little bit, something people don't think about. And in order to better understand our dogs and better understand how we can show up for them in a better way, in a healthier way for them that perhaps we have in the past, to build a better communication with them. I think it would be great if you could just touch a little bit on what decolonization means when it comes to, when we're talking about our dogs.
Sure. So first,
does that make sense?
Yeah. I think the first thing to remember is a lot of people think that get nervous around the topic because they think that it's a conversation yeah. around racism, which it isn't.
Right.
Colonization is something that people across the world have done across, you know, generations. And it's an idea mm-hmm. of kind of going into a space and claiming that space and all the living beings around there as owned by them. And so a big part of ownership right. and ownership is a power play. So a big part of ownership is I own the space. The grass here will look the way I want it to. The trees here will look the way I want it to. The people here will behave the way I want them to. And the animals will behave the way I want them to. And that is my exertion right. of power over what I own. And because I own it, it's my right to expect this and enforce this one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And of course, one way of enforcing it in the past has been through, even on human beings, has been through very uncomfortable ideas like slavery and things like that. But that went sure. away, and we've moved into an entirely different form of colonization, which is a bit more of a biopower kind of a colonization. So Foucault talks about this, the French philosopher. Biopower is when we are kind of use different other kinds of different social pressures to insist that, you know, mm-hmm. we own you, and not necessarily ownership, but mm-hmm. you will, you know, modern day governments also do this on a lot of us, that you will behave the way we want it to, because certain behaviors considered appropriate, certain behaviors considered, you know, not good for the powers that may be. And
right.
we internalize this so much that we become part of this this structure that enforces biopower. And so if you see a lot of times the discussion around what dogs should be, this is largely driven by these ideas. They have to be under control. They have to be obedient. Now, don't forget that very similar terms and terminology was used around and is still used around, for instance, women in many parts of the world. Mm-hmm. Keep your woman under control. Mm-hmm. Your women have to be obedient. They have to be, you know, seen, not heard, you know, all those ideas. Mm-hmm. Of course, in some cultures, those ideas around women are considered outdated, but they still persist in the case of animals. So if you're going to have an animal mm-hmm. in your home, they better be under control. They better behave the way, mm-hmm. you know, society will accept them to behave. And we should not mm-hmm. forget that this idea of, you know, society will accept them is very culturally laden. So it's not a universal thing. What your society mm-hmm. may think is absolutely the basic common denominator for animal etiquette may not be so in another part of the world. For instance, free-living dogs. Mm-hmm. Now, free-living dogs mm-hmm. are what we call dogs that occupy liminal spaces, in-between spaces. They're not wild animals. And this distinction is more of a sort of post-enlightenment, you know, Europe, North America kind of an idea, which is separating mm-hmm. nature and culture. Wild animals stay away from human beings and they're wild and we need to try and tame them. And domestic animals are animals that are under our control. They have to be glad that we give them life and we give them food and they will behave the way we want them to. And the idea of sort of concepts like bringing civilized behavior in is about taming this wild side, taming nature and things like that. Whereas if you look mm-hmm. at free-living dogs in India, they occupy a space that's neither here nor there. That's a liminal space. It's an in-between space. It's a very disadvantaged, disenfranchised space where there are, look at where we started our conversation, right? There aren't even words to describe them. Mm-hmm. That's how disenfranchised right. they are. And when we don't even have words right. to describe them, what are we going to do in terms of looking at their welfare and what's right and wrong for them? And frequently, there's such a discomfort around their just very existence. I've heard all kinds of things being told. Oh, they're going to get disease and they're going to get, you know, they don't mm-hmm. have a good life. Look around a country like India. There are a lot of animals that mm-hmm. are, you know, have disease. It's a normal part of life. There's ups and downs. There is injury. Right. There is hurt. Right. There is heartbreak. And that happens to people too. And it happens to animals too. But when did we decide and how did we decide on their behalf that injury and, you know, those kind of, you know, challenges of their life are something that they are willing to, want not to have it and are willing to trade their freedom away so that mm-hmm. they don't experience this. Mm-hmm. Challenges in life are something mm-hmm. that are part of free living lives of human beings, animals, all existence. But how did we come to decide that, you know, you're better off giving up your freedom, you're better off being owned by us and, you know, not have those challenges? That again is a rhetoric that is so entrenched in colonization, right? You are better mm-hmm. off being owned rather than living your wretched, miserable lives.
Right.
And it gets very uncomfortable if I don't tell you who I'm referring to, right? If I don't say, if you're talking mm-hmm. about animals, sometimes it feels very normalized. But if you say the same thing to human beings, it feels, you know, your skin crawls. But that is the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely the rhetoric of mm-hmm. colonization. So decolonization is about questioning those ideas, questioning the nature-culture divide and the superiority of culture over nature, looking at these liminal spaces and recognizing that they didn't become liminal and they didn't become disenfranchised on their own. We did that with our ideas of what is civilized, what is not civilized, what is permissible, mm-hmm. what's not, where animals belong and where they don't. And I think in the context of knowledge and in the context of dogs as well, so dog-related knowledge, animal-related knowledge, colonization also comes in terms of owning knowledge, claiming intellectual mm-hmm. property and not letting it. And a lot of this is generational knowledge. Dealing with animals is a lot of generational knowledge that usually sits with indigenous people. And it is something that mm-hmm. grows through generations and of input, you know, thousands and thousands of mm-hmm. years of wisdom that has kind of passed on. Philosophy and philosophical beliefs have gone into shaping this knowledge. It's a very different kind of a knowledge. And it is very sad for me to see that today we have people kind of swooping in and picking up the knowledge and claiming intellectual property over it. It's a intellectual colonization. And what we do disservice to ourselves when we do that. Just about 10 minutes before we got on this call, somebody said this, I'm building a vernacular home here. And we've come up with a new plastering technique, which ironically uses dog hair in it. And so it's a conversation for a whole other audience.
Easy. That's a whole other podcast.
And then somebody said, patent it. And I said, I hate that idea of patents because when I do that, I become the bottleneck. I become the be all and end all of that knowledge. It can't grow past me. Whereas this is knowledge about our living world, generational knowledge about earth, mud, growing things, seeds and things like that. It didn't start with us. We have no business coming in, swooping in and making it end with us. We have to grow.
Right.
We are custodians of knowledge. It is knowledge that belongs to the community. Our responsibility is to come and create space for it to grow and thrive. And we do our little bit and we go away and we are just one footnote in that growth of knowledge. Right. And we have to be okay with that. We have to have the humility to be okay with that and not try to claim ownership over living beings, over generational knowledge, over communities, over soil, over animal lives and sentient beings. That I think we have to fundamentally ask ourselves, when did we become so insecure that we just need to own everything? It's like a dog, you know, I frequently see a misunderstanding about dog peeing behavior and people say dogs pee to mark territory. Now, territory marking behavior is often only seen within one's territory. But frequently with dogs, you will see that mm-hmm, they will mm-hmm. go to new places and pee. And I used to use an analogy with my students to say, you know, the idea of every new place that you go to and say, mine, claim it as mine, mine. Dogs are not Alexander the Great or something like that, right? They're not doing that. But we do that. So I understand where we are getting that idea from. That is, every new place we go to, we want to grab and put a flag there and say, mine. And that is that, going away from that and decentralizing it and involving the community, I think that is at the heart of decolonizing just general aspects to life and our relationship with the natural world.
Yeah. Going back to understanding that really that they are living sentient beings and they have choice in how they live their lives. And what happens when you take away the choice of any kind of being, it causes frustration and behavioral issues and all sorts of things if you're not able to, you know, be who you are.
Yeah. So, sorry, just one last thing is, I think in the context of our community, companion animals, I think I didn't address how colonization kind of creeps in, which is, again, the expectation and the biopower. And just far too frequently, the conversation is about what people think, what experts think dogs should be, rather than what the sentient being is, what is the best version of them. And again, we are putting ourselves front, right, and center in that discussion. You know, this is, I am a global expert. I am recognized by so-and-so. I am peer-reviewed. And therefore, my knowledge about dogs trumps everything else, including the dog's knowledge about himself. So I think that's a very micro example of a decolonizing where, you know, at least between your dog and you, I mean, imagine if this were the case with partners, right? If you have a partner at home and you said, I know what's best for you all the time. And that would, there are people like that. And that is called an abusive relationship.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
You feel trapped and you feel confined and you feel frustrated and all of those things. How do you think your work can make us better companions, taking everything that you've learned for our dogs? How can we show up for them in a better way? Would it be what you just said, realizing that they're sentient beings and giving them choice? Or
I think if there's one takeaway that people I would like for people to have when they look at my work is just humility. And I really think that's the starting point. Stop expecting yourself to be, stop putting pressure on yourself and at the same time get off that pedestal. You are not the expert of the dog. The dog is the expert of the dog. So I think if you make that switch, you start with that. And often I hear my students will message me, what do you think is right for my dog, this or this? And I repeatedly tell them this. You should not be asking me that question. You have the tools to ask your dog that question. If you don't, gain the tools, gain practice to ask your dog that question. That should be the focus of the way we live with dogs. How do I bridge this communication gap so that I can ask you that question and I can understand your answer? And from there, I think then a partnership starts evolving. Then you might say, okay, I get it, but I can't do that for you. Let's find a mid-road.
Right.
I get it, but, and I get you want choice. I can't enable it the way you want to. I can't let you, you know, just go on a walk without a leash because, you know, I don't have that, you know, right given to me by society. Right. I can't. But what can I do? Can I put you on a long, long leash and let you pick the direction you want to go? Can I let you pick the duration of the walk? Maybe I, you know, I am, you know, a victim of biopower myself. I have to turn up at office from this time to this time. But can I give you freedom of saying, I want to skip a walk a day? Or I want to extend the walk by 10 minutes, right? Can I buffer in 10, 15 minutes? Can I, instead of giving you the same meal every day, can I have a choice of two things and give you a choice, A or B? And if you pick A, you're going to have B for night, for dinner. And that's my restriction. I have, you know, limited pockets. But now that I understand that that matters to you, can I create at least the illusion of choice so that you feel a bit more in control of your life? And this feels a bit more like a partnership rather than a one-sided ownership. And it will always be ownership, because the truth is that we have extraordinary power. It's an extraordinary power imbalance in this relationship. But if we bring in humility and bring in the recognition that they too have desires, they too want some control, some autonomy over their bodies, what goes in, what comes out, where they put their body, where they want to move their body, how much, and so on and so forth, who they want to be friends with, who they want to permit them to touch them, and who they want to touch, and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. If we recognize that they have a right to it, which we have kind of unfairly taken away from them because we want to enjoy their company, and it's okay, I'm not judging. I have a dog in my house too, and I tell her this. I say, you know, you've become mine for mama's reason, so I understand. Mm-hmm. But in that reflexivity, in that honesty, there is room for me to ask her, I'm trying my best to do this for you. What can I do? Let's work something out.
Right.
And I think something extraordinary comes out of it. People frequently tell me, oh, your dog is such a well-trained dog. I don't do any training. Nothing. None. I'm a terrible trainer and I don't do it. I don't even keep treats at home. It's not a thing at all. But she communicates with me as if she can understand my words. And I think that has come from that attachment that we have built, that secure connection and attachment that we have built. And that comes from, I think, number one, having the humility. I am not the expert. Mm-hmm. Chiru is the expert of Chiru, not me. Two is, I recognize I have power here, and I will use that responsibly, or rather try not to use it, and see how I can manage my space fairly for you, manage my life fairly for you. Yeah. And quite honestly, I have discovered that when I start taking that approach, it extends to human beings very quickly. And the othering that we do for human beings who are not like us, and we try to exert power over them, we start questioning that. And I think our lives get way less stressful, and we are a lot more at peace with, you know, the world around us when we start looking at things like this. It's liberating.
Yeah, that's absolutely, that's great. Do you want to talk a little bit about your workshops and your book? You have a really amazing book. That's on my website, thebrew.com, by the way. So
sure. So I have a book called Dog Knows, Learning How to Learn from Dogs, where I talk about my learning journey, all the mistakes that I made. Like I said, I don't like to preach. I would rather get reflexive. Everything that I spoke about are things that I have done wrong. Everything that one can do wrong, I have done it. And I talk about that journey.
Yeah, me too.
and of course, along with my experiences, I kind of back it up with what scientific knowledge is currently available. And we do a workshop called Canine Essential 101, where we lay the foundation out for, how is it that we manage dogs without any training? It's just a novel way of looking at things. Well, I wouldn't say novel. I think it's been in the works for a long, long time with a lot of people. But I think in the dog training world, it's considered, I don't consider it novel, but I think it is considered novel and new and a bit edgy. And along with, for people who sign up for Canine Essential 101, we also have a space called the Barks Auditorium, where we conduct a 2 to 3 live events a month, where we create a safe space for very, very edgy conversations. I encourage people to be very reflexive and be very bold about their ideas, things, concepts that people don't usually are quite nervous to talk about. You know, scientists are nervous to talk about, R+ trainers are nervous to talk about. So we go in there boldly, but with empathy and reflexivity. And that's kind of the extension of CE 101, built on those concepts. And of course, I also, at the end of all my talks about streeties, I also like to talk about giving back to streeties, because I think it's absolutely unfair to try and learn from them and not give back to them. And so for anybody who listens to this and feels like they've learned anything at all, even if you found it entertaining for a few minutes, I would love to recommend CARE as an organization that provides medical intervention for these dogs, state-of-the-art medical intervention for these dogs, and according to the constitution, returns them back to where they belong and does not just blindly take them off the streets, but does provide homes for dogs that cannot make it on the streets. So they strike a very good balance.
So people can donate to CARE.
Yes.
I'll put the link in the show notes for sure. And so people can easily link to that. Is there anything else that you wanted to add? This was such a lovely conversation, and I so appreciate you chatting with me.
No, I think I've said a lot. Thank you for the opportunity.
I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Beru Podcast. If you're interested in donating to CARE, I've put a link in the show notes. And Sindor is also giving away the first chapter of her book for free, and she's offering a discount to Beru listeners to her course using code BERU2023. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and follow the Beru wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Beru Podcast. And if you have a story of canine companionship you'd like to share with me, or you have a question or even a comment, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me, Charlotte@theberu.com. Thanks, you guys. Let's chat next week.